In downtown Oakland, on August 2, 2007, journalist Chauncey Bailey was shot to death on the street as he walked to work. The murder was a brazen act, committed in broad daylight in front of multiple witnesses. Yet the truth about who was responsible for the death of the longtime newsman and why he died was almost buried by a rushed criminal justice system. The murder and lack of a substantial investigation sparked an unprecedented collaboration between Bay Area journalists. They scoured thousands of documents and interviewed hundreds of sources. They were putting together the pieces of how Bailey was murdered because of a story he was working on about a North Oakland business and organization called Your Black Muslim Bakery. That journalistic investigation ultimately helped put the conspirators responsible for Bailey's death behind bars. Thomas Peel writes for the Oakland Tribune and was a reporter on the Chauncey Bailey Project. He's written a new book called Killing the Messenger. It's about Bailey's murder and the history behind the Black Muslim organization that was tolerated by Oakland officials for decades. Peel sat down to talk about his work with KLW's criminal justice editor, Rena Palta.
You know, most people are aware of Orthodox Islam being the religion that most Muslims in the world practice. How is that different from what was practiced at Your Black Muslim Bakery?
The people at Your Black Muslim Bakery practiced a fictive version of Islam that had its roots in 1920 Chicago in a group called the Moore Science Temple of America, and in the early 1930s in Detroit, where a guy who was basically a con man named Wallace Farad went door to door in the ghetto talking to people about their African Americans, about their identity, about where they had come from and how they didn't know who they were and that their true religion was not Christianity, that it was Islam, or what he defined as Islam. It was not the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad. This was his claims included that Caucasians and Jews were devils, that they had been created 6,600 years earlier by a mad scientist named Big-Headed Yaqub through grafting experiments. He claimed that there was a mile-wide spaceship called the Mother Plane orbiting the Earth that was always prepared to launch bombers that would cause Armageddon. It was a bunch of fables. He also, early on, preached violence. He told his followers that they could win heavenly rewards by killing four devils. They could went a trip to Mecca. He told them that this was Islam. He was doing this to people who had no idea what Islam really was.
We're talking with Thomas Peel, author of the new book, Killing the Messenger. So obviously the bakery was much more than just a bakery, and the religion was more even than a religion. It kind of became this cult. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what life was like inside Your Black Muslim Bakery for the followers of Yusuf Bey.
It was, by the accounts that exist, very oppressive, especially for women and children. Yusuf Bey preached that women were the floor upon which their men walked, that women were to submit to men, and especially to him. I mean, it was a polygamist cult, and he was its central leader. He dubbed dozens of women to be his spiritual wives by his decree and his decree only. He fathered more than 40 and perhaps more than 50 children with these women and girls, leaving his paternity off birth certificates, forcing the women to apply for public assistance as unwed mothers and then taking the money from them. He treated men with more respect. He dubbed many men who came to follow him as his spiritually adopted sons, and he taught them sort of the fundamental bases of the Nation of Islam's original dogma, even though he had separated from it and was running his own show. He was right back to the original teachings that we talked about, the white devils, big-headed Yakub, the mother plane up there, the approaching Armageddon, all of that. And he very much taught that violence should be the default mechanism for his followers to deal with any problem. He often preached that Caucasians, in his words, were the scientists for evil, and he urged combat in all situations.
So there were two sisters who would eventually turn Yusuf Bey in for sexual abuse, and they had been brought to the bakery by their father, who thought he couldn't take care of them anymore. And they were eventually, I believe, adopted by one of Yusuf Bey's plural wives. And when they were very young, he started abusing them. And I'm going to have you read an excerpt from your book, Killing the Messenger.
All of Bey's tender pretenses quickly vanished after Jane and Nancy's father agreed that he could raise them. Bey told Jane that she was old enough to learn how to submit and please a man. He started raping her before her first period. He would leave her face bruised and swollen from his fists. Her whole body shook from the threats that he would kill her and her family and dump their bodies in the bay if she told anyone. He threatened that if she didn't submit, he'd take her to San Francisco and pimp her, that the Johns there would do worse things to her than he did, if that was somehow possible. He broke her will through heinous subhuman acts, forcing her to swallow her feces, urinating in her mouth, and then smothering her with her hands, forcing her to swallow as she gagged and thrashed. He would sodomize her and then force her to perform oral sex on him. Jane and Nancy, whom Bey also continually abused, got no protection from Alice, though she was their legal guardian, charged with keeping them safe. Rather, Alice was Bey's enabler, even prepping the girls for him, bathing them, powdering them, fixing their hair. He would take them into her bedroom as she stood there, watching the door closed. Once, Nancy courageously confronted Alice. How could she allow this man in his 40s, this supposedly pious minister who went on cable television every week, preaching upright behavior, to rape and violate her, telling her to submit, slapping her face, peeing on her? He doesn't do anything to you that he doesn't do to the rest of us, Alice replied, telling Nancy that all of Bey's so-called wives feared he would kill anyone who failed to submit to him.
That was an excerpt from Thomas Peale's new book, Killing the Messenger.
So he knew that the end was coming, and he had appointed a successor to run the business end of the bakery, a man named Wajid Elijahwad, who was a CPA, who was his money man. He wanted him to run the business because the sons that he wanted to eventually take over were not old or certainly not mature enough and experienced enough to run the business. But Mr. Elijahwad, a few months after Bey's death, turned up missing. About 6 months after that, his body was found in a shallow grave in East Oakland. There was a particular line of children with one mother, a woman to whom I give the pseudonym Tammy in the book, that were his favorites. The oldest of which was a young man named Antar Bey. And Antar Bey is widely believed to have ordered the murder of Mr. Elijahwad to take control of the business. His father had appointed him to be the spiritual leader, but he wanted the money too. So Mr. Elijahwad is killed and Antar takes control of the bakery. But in the fall of 2005, he was shot dead at a gas station. And it was widely believed at the time that it was a random act, that it was a carjacking. He was driving a very expensive BMW. And it was kind of a carjacking gone bad. In fact, the person who shot Antar had been hired by his younger brother, Yusuf IV. The young man who shot Antar was convicted but never acknowledged that he was a hitman. In fact, he just maintained his innocence, mistaken identity and incidents through his trial, and he's now serving a life term. So that, in the fall of 2005, left Yusuf Bey IV in in charge of both the business and the so-called religious aspects of the organization.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. KLW's criminal justice editor, Rena Palta, is talking with Thomas Peel. He's a reporter with the Oakland Tribune, and he's authored a new book called Killing the Messenger. It's about the murder of Chauncey Bailey and the history behind the Black Muslim organization that was tolerated by Oakland officials for decades. Now let's go back to that interview.
So I think you describe Yusuf IV as someone that a lot of people within the bakery considered fairly mentally unstable. Tell us more about him and his personality.
The difference between Yusuf IV and his father was that his father had at least been out in the world. You know, his father had grown up in Christian churches in Texas, migrated with a family to California, spent 4 years in the Air Force. His records were have never been available because they were destroyed, as many military records were, in a massive fire in St. Louis. But he was in the Air Force. So he'd had exposure to people and the world, and even though he fell into this very fictive version of Islam, he kind of knew how to get along. He was a bit pragmatic, and he was also smart, charismatic, and greedy, and a vociferous sexual predator. Fourth only knew that compound on San Pablo Avenue. He only knew the teachings of this fictive version of Islam. He had no reference points at all in the larger world. He was kind of a young, wild man, completely out of control. And we've had people in the family say that, you know, he always appeared from adolescence on to be mentally unbalanced, and it was kind of proven out in this bloodlust of his that he got a great deal of pleasure, not necessarily from killing himself, but having the power to order people to kill for him. He meets the class, even though he has three victims that we know of, is enough to meet the classic definition of a serial killer.
So how did Chauncey Bailey get wrapped up in all this, considering he was an editor at the Oakland Post, which is an African-American paper in Oakland, and he hadn't been super critical of your Black Muslim bakery or the Bays, it seems. How did he get caught up in this web?
You know, it kind of goes back to the murder of Wajid Elijahwad that we spoke about a few minutes ago. There were really kind of two groups inside the bakery. There were the biological children of Yusuf Bey, Antar, Fourth, their brothers and sisters, and others, and their myriad of half-siblings. There were then the men who came into the bakery who Bey the Elder called his spiritually adopted sons. Elijahwad was one of those people. And there was this thinking among the other spiritually adopted sons that clearly Elijahwad had been murdered to get control of the money. And there was one fellow in particular named Salim Bey who had married one of Bey the Elder's daughters. So he was a spiritually adopted son and a son-in-law and Fourth's brother-in-law. By the summer of 2007, as things were really unraveling at the bakery, Salim Bey was telling people that the bankruptcy itself was illegal or illegitimate because Fourth's ownership of the bakery was illegitimate. But he wasn't getting any traction. So he started telling this to Chauncey Bailey, and he agreed that he would source Chauncey Bailey for a story about what was going on at the bakery as long as he was an anonymous source, because he was deathly afraid of the potential violence of his young brother-in-law, Bay Fourth. So Bailey wrote a story based on Salim as the single source. It certainly wasn't an investigative piece. He certainly didn't dig into anything. I don't believe that he ever looked at the bankruptcy documents. The publisher of the Post, Paul Cobb, claims that he rejected that story for a lack of attribution and the single anonymous source. Bailey then went and spoke with a lawyer who Salim Bey had consulted with. And the lawyer agreed that some of the information in the story could be attributed to him. There weren't a lot of secrets here. The bankruptcy was a year old. It had been reported in several business newspapers. It was a matter of public record. It wasn't, you know, a deep secret. In fact, Forth was admitting he was in bankruptcy because he was asking people to help him out of bankruptcy. Salim Bey met with Chauncey Bailey at the Oakland Post downtown. On the way out, he happened to run into a woman who at one time had been one of Bay the Elder's plural wives. She worked at the Post selling advertising. Salim Bey testified that as soon as he saw her, he knew that the fact that he had been meeting with Bailey was going to get back to people at the bakery very quickly. And he concocted a cover story kind of on the spot, telling the woman he'd been there, telling Bailey about his a computer business that he ran, because Bailey often wrote feature stories about African-American entrepreneurs. So Salim leaves, but Bailey then tells this woman what he's working on and asks her some questions about Forth. She has denied that she told anybody what Bailey was working on. She's kind of blamed him, saying that he told too many people that he was working on a story about the bakery. To skip forward slightly, Bay Forth, though, eventually told police that he learned that Bailey was working on a story through his sister, one of his sisters, who had a friend who worked at the Oakland Post. So it's a pretty clear line that Salim Bey ran into this woman, Chauncey talked to this woman, this woman told people within the bakery that Bailey was working on a story, and that got the Forth, and Forth then kind of became obsessed with that story. He also very bizarrely blamed Bailey in part for his father's death, because Bailey had covered the sex abuse case. He'd written about it pretty extensively for the Oakland Tribune. Pretty routine court coverage stories, except that did involve Yusuf Bey. And Devondre Brassard eventually testified that Bay Forth claimed that the stress of this negative, slanderous coverage, as he put it, hastened his father's death. So now Forth, who has these incredibly violent tendencies, who has ordered two other people killed, who thinks that those murders are never going to come back on him, and this is greatly enhancing his ego and his power, decides that he can help himself greatly thwart the bankruptcy proceedings if he stops Bailey from publishing this story by killing Bailey.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. KLW's Rena Palta is talking with Thomas Peel about his new book called Killing the Messenger. It's about the murder of journalist Chauncey Bailey and about your Black Muslim bakery, the organization ultimately responsible for his murder. Let's go back to that conversation now.
One of the crazy things for me in reading this book was how close it came to no one ever finding out that Yusuf Bey IV was actually responsible for Bailey's death, as well as the other two men that you mentioned. And I think we're going to play a clip of the video that the Chauncey Bailey Project found of Yusuf Bey talking about Bailey's murder while he was in jail for a different, he was awaiting charges on a different crime that we haven't even gotten a chance to talk about.
Yeah.
But we're going to play.
There were so many crimes.
Exactly. But we're going to play that.
Listen, no, what else was got the night before the gun that was used was in my closet. The only reason why I took it out of my room that night was because as a van kept going back and forth from the gate, the brothers were scared, so I gave him my gun. The one that they used.
Trying to pay the shot.
But I had it in my room the whole time after it happened. Shells in her and everything. I didn't even touch it since he did it. But the night before, like at 11 o'clock, they told me a van must have been an FBI van. I kept working back. I came back to Trace and in case something happened, he never gave it back to me.
We just heard a clip from the Chauncey Bailey Project. We're speaking with Thomas Peel, who wrote the new book, Killing the Messenger, about Bailey's death. And can you just tell us how close it came to no one ever actually finding out that Yusuf Bey was responsible for killing Chauncey Bailey?
Well, first, if Devondre Broussard or Yusuf Bey, who sent him to kill Chauncey Bailey, had gotten rid of the murder weapon, a little sawed-off pistol grip 12-gauge shotgun, no one would have been charged. That was the key thing that got Broussard charged when police raided the bakery the next day. He was found in possession of the weapon. The weapon was quickly traced to shotgun shells found next to Bailey's body. Broussard had thrown that, had that gun, and he had thrown it out his bedroom window as police were storming the portion of the bakery compound where he and Antoine Mackey lived. Now, ironically, he had given the gun back to Bay Forth right after the murder, and Bay Forth had put it in his bedroom closet, ejected a shell from it, spent shell laying on his bedroom floor, didn't bother to pick it up, put the gun in his closet. Later that night, though, he thought that somehow the FBI had the bakery under some type of surveillance because he'd seen a van outside, and he immediately thought it was the FBI because, of course, he was so important in his mind that naturally if he was something was going on with law enforcement, they'd need the FBI to deal with him. So he gave the gun back to Broussard, told Broussard, stay up and guard things. Broussard was tired, and he went to bed instead, threw the gun aside. He was, you know, soundly asleep when the bakery was raided a few hours later, and he threw the gun out the window. If they didn't have the gun, they didn't have any evidence. So right from the get-go, if these guys had had sense enough to get rid of the murder weapon, nobody would have been charged.
All right, I guess I wanted to get to this point that the Bays were tolerated in Oakland for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone from the police to city officials to, you know, district attorneys kind of had a vague sense of what was going on there. So just the vast incompetence at the level of, it seems like Mayor Dulles was implicated, the police department turned a blind eye to what was going on there. Is this like an only in Oakland situation, or could this happen in San Francisco or Los Angeles or a number of cities?
You know, it's not necessarily unique to Oakland, but Oakland has a series of unique situations that lend itself greatly to this happening, including the fact that the police department is historically underfunded, understaffed, overworked, outgunned on the street, and that the voters in Oakland have fairly routinely, including just in November, voted down tax increases to help fund the police department. The police department today has about 650 officers, and Anthony Batts, who resigned last year, as we all know, in the midst of his contract for being chief of police, claimed that at minimum he needed 1,000 officers to adequately police the city. The police department also historically has got a well-earned reputation of abuse and violence in the African-American community that kind of creates this catch-22, is they can't convince people to give them money for more funding because people think that more funding will simply not help the department. So that's a piece of it right there that is very unique to Oakland. Oakland is also a tolerant place, and rightfully so. And Yusuf Bey was very good at exploiting that tolerance by propping himself up as a civic leader.
We're talking with Thomas Peel, author of Killing the Messenger, a book out just last week. And I just in wrapping up here, I want to go back to the murder case itself. And I want to play a clip of Nancy O'Malley, the current district attorney in Alameda County, who you quote in your book as being one of the few city officials in Oakland to actually recognize the importance of the Chauncey Bailey case.
These verdicts also stand for our abiding conviction that violence against a free voice of the press will not be tolerated in our society or in our community.
That was Alameda County District Attorney Nancy O'Malley, and we're talking with Thomas Peel. Could you explain why this case is such an important one and why no one in Oakland seemed to recognize it.
Sure. This case is about the First Amendment. Chauncey Bailey was a 57-year-old weekly newspaper editor and reporter. He had been fired from the Oakland Tribune for some ethical mishaps that were substantial. They're detailed in the book. He, at one point in his career, had covered Detroit for the Detroit News. He'd made it in journalism. He was a big city newspaper reporter on the beat. But he was in a downward career spiral where he ended up at the Oakland Post, which no one will confuse with a quality newspaper. But yet none of that really mattered when he was killed because he was pursuing a story, when he in his own way was attempting to speak truth to power by writing about your black Muslim bakery. It wasn't an investigative piece. It was far from that. I'm one of the few people who's read it, the unpublished story. But he was a journalist doing his job. He was covering the community. He knew everybody in Oakland, and everybody knew him. He was the guy who showed up with a camera at a kids' track meet at 8 o'clock on a Sunday morning so he could put something positive about ghetto kids in the newspaper. And there's clearly value to that. His murder was an assault on the First Amendment. It was larger than Oakland. It was larger than a street murder. Yet there was little acknowledgement of any meaning to his murder in Oakland beyond the fact that he was killed by thugs from the black Muslim bakery. In Detroit, where he had a lot of friends and had worked for a long time, his former city editor at the Detroit News immediately captured what it meant at a memorial. And he said at a memorial service in Detroit a few days later that Bailey's murder was an attack on the American way of life, which we all enjoy a free press. And our democracy is held accountable by a free press. Nobody in Oakland said that. That's in part why when District Attorney O'Malley said that at the conclusion of the trial, that it was significant, that it had finally been said. But when Chauncey Bailey was killed almost 4 years earlier at that point, when Mrs. O'Malley said that, no one said it. The mayor didn't say it. The police chief didn't say it. The then district attorney didn't say it. As soon as Devondre Broussard admitted to pulling the trigger in a confession that was deeply flawed because he claimed that he acted alone, it's kind of the end of the investigation. At that point, it was just string the run out. Nobody was that interested in charging Yusuf Bey IV. He had been picked up in this other case that we've referenced, this kidnapping and torture case, and he was facing life without parole for that. And there was really no apparent interest in holding him accountable for ordering a newspaper reporter killed to silence a story. And that frightened a lot of people in journalism, not just in Oakland. Chauncey Bailey was the first reporter working on a fairly routine domestic story in the United States to be killed since a man named Don Bowles of the Arizona Republic was died in a car bombing in 1976. This is a very unique event in American history and American journalism for a reporter to die on American soil over a story.